Good morning. This is a decent crowd for a Mother's Day. So welcome.
We had a mother and child.
Welcome, everyone. I'll go around and say hi, starting with Alice. And Alice, who was that we just saw?
That was Ava.
Hello, Ava.
Hello, Ava.
This is what she made for Mother's Day. A piece of soap. With show them the rose.
Oh. The rose.
Oh, beautiful.
That's beautiful.
Thanks.
She's gorgeous. She looks just like you.
She makes soap. That's her hobby.
That's a really cool hobby.
Yeah. So one day you guys might expect a package of soap in the mail.
And Linda, R, Sam, Bob K, Jinryu, Jim, Mark, Paulette, Deborah, Marv, Joan, Karen, Ken, Ava, Pat, John, Etzido, Sandy, Sarah, and Ruth Ann. All right. I can't think of any particular announcements. Anybody think of anything I should announce or have any questions about what's coming up or anything like that?
Book group next Saturday.
All right. If you're curious about that, go look at the website or check the weekly newsletter. Okay. Today's talk is what does it mean to waste time? And I confess that when I am contemplating, you know, what am I going to talk about? Very often, you know, I talk about something that is coming up for me. I have felt lately like I've made a lot of commitments and I got to finish them. And there's kind of too many. And so I feel kind of, you know, stressed and frantic about trying to get it all done. And this has to happen and that has to happen and that has to happen. And so I haven't felt very mindful, or my zazen hasn't felt very focused. And so, you know, I think about in particular, like Zen Master Dogen's like practice as if your hair is on fire, and raising that question of like, well, what does that mean? And what has been lacking in my practice? Has anything been lacking in my practice? You know, can you waste time? I don't know. So from the beginning, in Buddhism, we've been encouraged to make great effort. This has never been portrayed as like, here's an easy path. No problem. Just, you know, it's understood from the beginning that whether you were a monk or a lay person, that this was going to take some work. So just out of curiosity, today I have the Kindle version of Dogen's Shobo Genzo, which has like, what, 75, 96 chapters. And one of the things that's cool about the Kindle version is that you can do a search the whole book. So I did a search, wasting time. And actually, I think I searched for wasting time and I didn't search for waste time. So there might've been more. Well, wasting time, I found it mentioned in the Shobo Genzo 32 times. So here's one of them. And this is from the chapter Continuous Practice. In the continuous practice of the way of Buddha ancestors, do not be concerned about whether you are a great or modest hermit, whether you are brilliant or dull. Just forsake name and gain forever, and don't be bound by myriad conditions. Do not waste the passing time. Brush off the fire on top of your head. If you have a home, leave your home. If you have beloved ones, leave them. If you have fame, abandon it. If you have gain, escape from it. If you have fields, get rid of them. If you have relatives, separate from them. If you don't have name and gain, stay away from them. This is the single track of continuous practice. To forsake name and gain in this lifetime and practice one thing thoroughly is the vast continuous practice of the Buddha's timeless life. This continuous practice is bound to be sustained by continuous practice. Love and respect your body, mind, and self that are engaged in this continuous practice. So just a note, the phrase practice as if you're putting out a fire on your head is one that you encounter in Zen repeatedly, as if the practice is the only way to put out the fire. So none of us here are monks. None of us here are renunciate monks. I mean, I spent some time doing that in my past, but I am not doing it now. So we have chosen to live in the world. We have chosen to have a home, beloved ones. You know, we need to make money. We need to engage in our daily lives. So what does this mean for us? From the beginning, the Buddha has made it clear that lay people can achieve the way. There were lay people who achieved, they always said like you couldn't achieve quite the highest level, but I mean much higher level than any of us are at, right? That these lay people achieved in terms of Buddhist attainment. So from the beginning it said that lay people can do this. So what does this mean? So one of the ways that we phrase this in my lineage is that there's monks of body and monks of mind. So a monk of body is someone who physically, literally enacts what Dogen was just talking about. They really leave home. They really sever relationships. They really cut off their hair. They really do all that, you know, letting go in a very literal way. But then there's also the monk of mind. So that is the layperson, or the person who stays engaged in the world, who doesn't literally give up those things, but gives them up, renounces them in the mind. So it's not necessary, even though sometimes it's helpful, to literally renounce these things, but it is possible and necessary to renounce them in our minds and hearts. Even if it's basically said that if you are a monk of body, you've renounced these things literally, but you did not renounce them in your mind, you're not also a monk of mind, then you're not worth very much. But you can be a monk of mind without being a monk of body, and that is sufficient. So what does it mean to renounce things? So I want to explore that and what it does and doesn't mean. So to go back to the sense of wasting time, that in a sense we're wasting time if we're not, you know, renouncing things in the way that we'll talk about. What does it mean for us to waste time as we remain engaged? So as we talk about this wasting time, I want to be clear from the start, and maybe we can return to this at some point. we are right to doubt what we think the teaching means. So this is something that my Dharma grandmother, Roshi Kennett, would say. You are right to doubt when you think it means. So when you hear a teaching and you go, what? So if I want to practice the way, I should get rid of my family? That sounds screwy. So we're right to trust that part of ourselves that says, I don't know, wait a second, that doesn't sound right. That doesn't sound like true Dharma. So we're supposed to trust that and yet stay engaged with the teaching and ask, okay, so what does that mean? It can't mean just like being selfish and rejecting all my responsibilities, right? So then what could it mean? So exploring it like that. So I want to say, like, wasting time. This message can't be so dualistic or shallow that it means engaging in lay life, engaging in the things of the world is inevitably wasteful, or any kind of pleasure is wasteful, or any kind of investment in life is wasteful. That's just, okay, so let's say that can't be that. That it can't be that the only way to fulfill the Buddha way is to reject the world and become an ascetic monk, okay? So just start there. And this teaching is not meant to shame us. So if we start to feel judged or rejected or inadequate, that this is not the purpose of the teaching. So and again, it's like, you know, questioning that, trusting, like, this is not the intention. So what else is going on here? Also, this is not about forming an ideal in our minds and then constantly comparing ourselves to it. Again, that's not all that helpful. So, and yet the Dharma, the teachings, the practices, the Sangha is meant to challenge us. It's not just meant to be a comforting affirmation of whatever it is that we happen to already be doing. You're super, you're great, no matter what. Like, there is no wasting time. Go ahead and do anything. I mean, we're not just here to make ourselves, well, we are here to make ourselves feel better, but we appreciate that some change might be required, some engagement, some challenge. So what does it really mean to waste time? And I would suggest that we know for ourselves that it is possible to waste time. Even though we like, okay, I know at some level maybe there's no wasting of time, but there's something. When we hear that term wasting time, we know what it feels like. We know when we're doing something and we're like, yeah, I'm kind of wasting time. So what does it feel like? So I thought I would do a shared screen brainstorm of what it means to waste time before we get into other things. So let me just pull this up. Okay. Just readjusting my screen so I can still see everybody. All right. Well, what do you think when you think about, I mean, maybe you never feel like you waste time, but in those times where it occurs to you, Karen?
Being unproductive.
Jim?
It implies having some outcome that you're not achieving whatever outcome it is.
Mark.
relitigating old arguments, reiterating old habits.
Alice.
Searching.
What?
Searching.
Searching? What do you mean by that?
Searching for something stimulating or an opportunity or an argument or an interaction. Just searching.
Something you don't yet have.
Searching and grasping, I guess.
Pat. You're still muted.
Thank you. When unproductive went up, I realized that I'm officially attached to some project, but so I want an outcome, but then procrastinating is what I think I do when I'm unproductive.
Etzidil.
So, you know, I think for me, it feel, you know, when I'm thinking about wasting time, it kind of feels like my actions are not in line with my values, my highest values and my deepest priorities. So doing something that really doesn't feel authentic.
Cool. Ruth Ann, did you want to say something?
Yes, please. A gnawing feeling of restlessness.
Interesting. Let's see. Sarah, I think, was next.
So maybe not what it means to waste time, but maybe what triggers the wasting time feeling would be thinking about your death or someone else's death, like regrets now that you've had that time taken away.
Linda R.
Hey, I can think of two things. During the pandemic, watching too much news. And the other thing that I do sometimes more than I would like is something has upset me or disappointed me, I think about it too much.
Good ones.
Marv.
It's wandering mind in general.
And Ava?
Complaining and justifying why I have or have not done something, telling myself stories.
Jinryu?
Worrying.
And Paulette?
I think it might have been already said, but overthinking.
So there's definitely a sense that I mean, it is possible to waste time. And I just wonder, you know, I guess when I was thinking about this and maybe what underlies all of this, and thank you, Etsido, for just basically saying exactly what I wanted to say, that there's all of these things tend to be like, we're not acting according to our own aspirations in some way, like, you know, we would like to be present and mindful and grateful or something, but instead we are worrying, even though we know that the worrying isn't useful, we're doing it anyway. And like Pat was saying with the projects, it's like, okay, so you've decided you want to do this project, or you recognize that it's important that you do it, but then you're procrastinating it over here, right? So you're out of alignment with your own intentions, which gives it a kind of, I don't know, kind of an icky feeling. So I don't know if that, you know, covers every single way of wasting time, but I thought that was interesting. So we know this feeling. And typically, you know, it does have a sense of a goal, that there's something that, you know, we're unproductive. We're not, you know, if it's productive use of time, then we're moving towards some kind of goal. And if it's wasted, we're not making any progress toward that goal. But I think in a sense of practice, that it's more subtle than that, you know, we don't have to necessarily be fixated on the goal. It's more that we are, you know, there's a direction that we're going. So it's not so much about the goal, but about, you know, I've chosen to walk in this direction. I want to tread this path. I want to be this kind of person, and I'm not acting in accord with that. So we recognize wasting time in our own body and mind. It's a feeling of being out of sync, not quite honest with ourselves, and lost and floating and being pulled and pushed by conditions, kind of letting stuff happen to us rather than, you know, making some kind of choice, which, you know, I guess when I think about it, some of the ways that I've been defining practice lately is, you know, the conscious choices that we make in order to live with greater, you know, wisdom and compassion and mindfulness and all of that. So the conscious choices we make. So if we're kind of gone slack and we're not making any conscious choices, we're just kind of letting stuff happen and going on our whims, then in some ways we're not practicing as much as we would are aspiring to, perhaps. And I would say, before we start exploring a little bit more, that to stop wasting time, that we don't compare ourselves to others or to some ideal or become fixated on our goal again, but just, I feel like we can really check in with ourselves. What do I really want to be doing in this moment? How do I really want to be acting in this moment? What is my aspiration? So checking in what we really want, but, you know, then the problem is that we have lots of competing desires. So it's not just about, well, what do I really want, and following whatever I want. I mean, we can, but that's not my aspiration. But what we desire most deeply. So like Etsido was saying, like, what's our deeper, and what do we really mean by that? Like a deeper desire. How do you differentiate a deeper desire from surface desires? So that brings me back to what Dogen said, just forsake name and gain forever and don't be bound by myriad conditions. So to some extent, we're exploring what these deeper desires are by starting to ask the question, or what are these shallower desires that are often pushing and pulling us away from our deeper aspirations. So name and gain. Name is reputation, social status and power, needing to be special in relationships. Like, I'm really special to this person and that person, being the most important person to someone, not in the sense of, not in so much a generous sense, but in a self-important sense. Gain, of course, profit, wealth, pleasure, comfort. And when we forsake something, we give it up, renounce it, leave it behind forever. And then he talks about, don't be bound by myriad conditions. So the myriad conditions that bind us, what are they? The things that cause us stress and fear and grasping and all of these things that we react to in our lives. It's not a practice response, but it's a reaction. So what does it mean to forsake name and gain, to refuse to be bound by myriad conditions in ordinary daily life? Because we're not literally giving them up. I mean, what does it mean to be, still be involved with things, but not overly attached to them? So I thought it would be fun to share with you an ideal. So again, this isn't an ideal that we're meant to just compare ourselves to, right? And you're wasting time if you're not acting like this guy. But more to hear this description. This is a description of the layman Vimalakirti. So the Vimalakirti Sutra is one of the earliest Mahayana sutras. And what's radical is that it's about a layperson. And he was an acclaimed practitioner of the Dharma. And he was sick. And the Buddha was asking his disciples to go please pay a kind visit to Vimalakirti and send the Buddha's regards and whatever. So the Buddha asks his disciples, he's like, okay, so-and-so, would you please go visit Vimalakirti? And then each one of them, so it goes through, so he has he asks 500 Arhat disciples and a similar number of Bodhisattva disciples, would you please go visit? And each one in turn, the sutra only contains about a dozen stories, but the implication is that all 1,000 disciples all have a story like this. So each one tells a story of having interacted with Vimalakirti. And Vimalakirti is like so far beyond them in terms of Dharma realization that they're like totally embarrassed. So they're like, oh, I don't know. I can't go visit Vimalakirti. He's way out of my league. So the Buddha goes through all like, 1,000 disciples and all like, oh. So it's basically then all these stories of how these wise teachings that Vimalakirti gave. And then finally, Manjushri says, that's all right. I'm willing to risk embarrassment and go visit him. So then the rest of the sutra is that interaction. But here's the description of Vimalakirti. So I find this useful because, Vimalakirti is like us. He is engaged in the world. So this is more of like, this is how, what does this ideal look like if you're not literally, leaving and giving everything up in that monk of body way? So as I read it again, like rather than hearing it just as, here's how you should be, here's another ideal to beat yourself up with, but more like when you hear it, like, is there something in you that resonates and you think, yeah, that's how I'd like to be. That's how I'd like to be able to be, And I think each one of us has different things that make us come alive, different aspirations, even if they're all essentially down to the same thing, they manifest in different ways. Some of us want to be deeply compassionate and patient, and some of us want to be really effective, and some of us really want to be good teachers, and some of us, you know. So here's the excerpt from the description of Vimalakirti. So, and I'll pause and elaborate a little bit as I go. So at that time, there lived in the great city of Vaisali a certain Lichavi, Vimalakirti by name. Having served the ancient Buddhas, he had generated the roots of virtue by honoring them and making offerings to them. He had attained tolerance as well as eloquence. I would definitely like more tolerance. And I would love for the people that I spoke to not only understand what I say, but also be convinced by what I say. He had penetrated the profound way of the Dharma. He was liberated through the transcendence of wisdom. So we all know that when we work on ourselves, when we work on our insights, that we're liberated from things like fear and anxiety and jealousy and inhibition and just the things that constrict us. So I would like to be more liberated. Having integrated his realization with skill in liberative technique, skillful means, he was expert in knowing the thoughts and actions of living beings, knowing the strength or weakness of their faculties, and being gifted with unrivaled eloquence, he taught the Dharma appropriately to each. So wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to have the patience and generosity to any person that you encounter to take yourself out of the picture and really perceive where this person is coming from, what might get through to them, and somehow be able to communicate in a way that brings them to greater peace and understanding. Having applied himself energetically to the Mahayana, he understood it and accomplished his tasks with great finesse. So I think this is one that really resonates with me. I would really love to just go around and accomplish my tasks with great finesse, with great, you know, dignity and ease and skill that's not constrained by self-consciousness or ambition or just a drive to get it done or something. He lived with the deportment of a Buddha, and his superior intelligence was as wide as an ocean. Wouldn't it be amazing to conduct yourself every day with the deportment of a Buddha? To not have our shoulders up like this and tension and fear and be gritting our teeth or having something in the pit of our stomach, but just, you know, to have that sense of ease and magnanimity. His wealth was inexhaustible for the purpose of sustaining the poor and the helpless. Nothing wrong with wealth. What if we went ahead and accumulated great wealth and power, and then were just so open-handed with it that it just flowed and it was used for the benefit of all beings? He observed a pure morality in order to protect the immoral. It's an interesting idea to restrain our behavior, to think about our behavior, not just in terms of how we should be, but in how it impacts others or inspires others. He maintained tolerance and self-control in order to reconcile beings who are angry, cruel, violent, and brutal. So maintaining self-control in the face of people who make us not want to feel that way, but for the purposes of actually trying to change them. He blazed with energy in order to inspire people who are lazy. He He maintained concentration, mindfulness, and meditation in order to sustain the mentally troubled. He wore the white clothes of a layman, yet lived impeccably like a religious devotee. He lived at home, but remained aloof from the realm of desire. So what is that? To be surrounded by, you know, to have a home, to have things we enjoy, to do things we enjoy, to have loved ones, to have pets, to take care of our lives, and yet be aloof from the realm of desire. I mean, I think I know what this feels like when I'm enjoying something and it feels like, but my hands are open. I'm not holding on to whatever it is and trying to like get more. Even if it's something that I really, really love, you know, my husband, my family, but in this sense of like, it's more gratitude. It's a relaxed kind of appreciation for what happens to be in our life. But the next step of grasping our desire, I want more of this, or I want to hold on to this, isn't entering into the picture. So it has a very different flavor. He appeared to be surrounded by servants, yet lived in solitude. So I don't think the important part here is servants, but to be lived surrounded by people, but to have a certain, I mean, what does it mean to live in solitude? To be centered and strong within your own being, instead of grasping for what you need or affirmations from other people. So you live with them, but not dependent on them in the same way. He understood the mundane and transcendental sciences and esoteric practices, yet always took pleasure in the delights of the Dharma. So this is one where, you know, with all my competing projects, do some of them end up overshadowing and drawing away from, you know, the Dharma, which I think of as, you know, staying rooted in that truth, in the practice, in my deeper aspiration. In order to be in harmony with people, he associated with elders, with those of middle age, and with the young, yet always spoke in harmony with the Dharma. He engaged in all sorts of businesses, yet had no interest in profit or possessions. So again, we kind of assume that if you're going to function in the world and make worldly headway, you're going to have to be like focused on profit and possession and reputation and gain and stuff like that, right? But this calls that into question. Is there a way to function really effectively, but not be attached to the outcome? To train living beings, he would appear at crossroads and on street corners. And to protect them, he participated in government. He was honored as the landlord among landlords because he renounced the aggressiveness of ownership. The aggressiveness of ownership. We're talking about ownership, the last one of the recent precept classes, do not steal. Ownership, what is that? Are there things that we can take responsibility for temporarily, but not have that aggressiveness of ownership that, you know, you have the exclusive right over it, and you want to control it. He was honored as the warrior among warriors because he cultivated endurance, determination, and fortitude. He was honored as the aristocrat among aristocrats because he suppressed pride, vanity, and arrogance. He was compatible with ordinary people because he appreciated the excellence of ordinary merits. I think that one is particularly sweet. Compatible with ordinary people because he appreciated the excellence of ordinary merits. Can we really interact with ordinary beings and see what the potential is in them? So, you know, according to the description, Vimalakirti had all of these qualities and skills and more. But I would suggest that, like, any one of these is very valuable in and of itself. So this is presented as an ideal, but it doesn't matter that, you know, it's not like we have to try to check all the boxes, right? That any one of these things could be a Dharma gate to deep practice. So I'm going to open it up, and I would love to hear about if anything in this list of things or just got you thinking, awaken that sense of, you know, what, in a sense, what is your, not that you have only one deeper aspiration, right? But does any of it resonate with a deeper aspiration that you have, that then it's in context, it's in that context that wasting time happens, right? In this practice sense, that if you are not acting in alignment in some way, it doesn't matter where you are between, you know, lame and your ideal. If you are going in that right direction, you're doing your best, then nothing more can be expected, right? So you're not wasting time as long as you are in some kind of alignment with that. So I guess before we get to that, I just wanted to suggest that in terms of not wasting time, I would suggest that whatever it is that we're doing, let us choose to do it. This is what makes our practice alive, authentic, personal, and grounded. So wherever we have this sense, okay, I'm getting that little bit of that sense of being out of sorts, out of sync, guilt, a sense of procrastination, something, that tension that arises when we feel like we're wasting time, which we're suggesting is now we're acting out of accord with what, you know, we, our deeper aspirations, with what we said we would do, with what we want to do, and at least part of us wants to do. So when we kind of wake up to that situation, that we just, whatever it is that we're doing, we try to wholeheartedly do it. And wholehearted in the sense of undivided. I wasn't here for chanting this morning because I was meeting with a Dharma group that Marv is part of, and we had a great discussion about wholehearted and what does that really mean, and undivided. And then another participant in the group said it was like radical inclusion, you know, radical acceptance, but also radical inclusion. I really liked that phrase, as anything that we are doing is included in our life and practice. And that, so that split between our aspiration and what we're doing, just, all right, now we're just going to become a bigger container and include that. Huh, look at that. And it's coming back to what we really want to do. So sometimes I think when we feel like we're wasting time, then we're like, oh, I should be doing that. And so there's a lot of shoulds that come to mind that we don't own. But I'm suggesting that we can own our time and our practice and our life. We can say, what's going on here, and how is it that I could be acting? What is it I could be doing to be more in alignment with what I really want? So We'll leave it there. Open it up for comments and questions. Karen.
One thing that I do is I can obsess over things that have happened in the past and have no control over because they've already happened, but I can lose a lot of sleep just ruminating over, you know, things that happened in the past, how things have played out in my life. And while this is happening, I'm also aware that it's complete waste of time. And I kind of have this inward mental battle in my brain, you know, just let it go. It's already gone. Can't change anything, but it's still so hard to not keep grasping to that. And it doesn't feel like I'm getting any satisfaction out of it, but my brain seems to like to do that.
I wonder what, because I've done that myself. Wonder what it is that we really want in that moment. You know, in a way, sometimes I think our habits and our brains and whatever, it's trying to get us what we want, but it's just not going about it in a way that's actually helpful. Because I know that, so I'll, it's the only thing that keeps me up, ever keeps me up is, you know, if I'm having an interpersonal thing with somebody, right? And then I'm kind of like rehearsing what I should say or why they didn't understand or something. And I guess when I look at like, what is it that I really want in that moment? It's like, I want understanding. I want harmony with this person. And it's almost like then sometimes that can shift, and it can be like, you know, thank you, mind. Thank you, mind, for all that rehearsing and rehashing. You know, I know you were really trying to help. But in this moment, as I really want to move toward that harmony, like one of the things that always occurs to me at that point is like, I don't know what this person is going to do next. I don't actually know what they're thinking, and I don't know what they're going to say next. So I'm going to look forward to seeing what happens next. And it just shifts the mind away from that rehashing the past or, you know, theoreticals into, I don't know. Ken.
Yeah, just to reinforce what Karen's saying, like, it feels like, and you too, Domio, it feels like when you ruminate or perseverate or whatever we call it now, it's like your rational mind is trying to grasp for a perspective on something that's going to make it okay. Mm. And it's just going to go poof, and it's not going to be a problem anymore.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work that way. But your rational mind refuses to accept that.
Yeah. Bob. You're still muted.
Too many buttons. That doesn't even look like my hand. I'm still back on wasting time, but I have some comments about both. But I used to use a phrase, and I've heard a phrase that not so much used anymore, called killing time.
Mm.
You know, have you ever heard that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that to me is like one of the most vicious things I've ever heard, now that I think about it. But wasting time is like, maybe not being fully present.
Aww.
And so I also have a habit of rehashing the past, and especially like you, if it's an interpersonal thing, just going over lots of scenarios about, I should have done this, or I should have done, or golly, why didn't I think of this? You know, that kind of thing. When actually I think it's been most helpful for me to invest my time and effort into not doing that as much as searching for the feelings that I've had, and just re-experiencing the feelings and seeing what happens without using my time to add layers of stories and other things, but just go back to the what's happening in my body. Mm-hmm. And when I do that, it's an amazing thing to me that I don't feel the necessity to engage in the storytelling. It kind of goes away. Mm. It's just not there anymore. And so it isn't like letting go. It's like, I don't know, there's got to be another term for it, but it's not like letting go, you know? It's like it became unnecessary. Mm. In a way. And I think that's a very important thing, but it's very hard to do, because I actually have thought that the best part of me is the mind that can make up stories. You know, I've actually believed that when I don't, you know, we know it's not true, but to unbelieve it or to believe in something different, It takes a while and a lot of experience to actually convince oneself. And I think the body is about the best way to do it. It's very simple. And those things never last. I mean, I've tried to be regretful for hours at a time, and that's so hard to do, or to be angry, to just carry my anger. It can't be done. I don't know about the rest of you, but I know some people can say they can carry a grudge forever, but it just doesn't happen if you just let the experience or the feeling and the body sensations kind of do their thing. So I don't know whether I spoke on the topic or not.
That was beautiful. And what you made me think of the fact that, you know, when you're wasting time in some way, particularly these like kind of compulsive, unfruitful ways, you know, so how do you stop wasting time? I think it's such a great example of how it's not like with our practice, we don't stop wasting time by like suddenly doing the opposite really noble thing. We stop wasting time as soon as we start paying attention, as soon as we turn toward the experience, as soon as we just try to be, like I said, undivided, like what's going on. Like we're in a sense, then in a deeper sense, we're not wasting time anymore, even if we're kind of still in the middle of the shit. We're in a practice sense, I think we're no longer wasting time.
Thank you. I think that kind of really encapsulated it for me. That you're using your time well.
You said certain things I was like, couldn't be said better. So
the last several comments, my favorite Dogen essay is being time. So as opposed to killing time or wasting time.
Ooh, yeah.
The practice is not to transcend time, maybe like some other religious traditions would have us do, but to fully enter and just to be time. Or he seems to mean impermanence or change itself, not like clock time or something abstract, but our practice is just being all the flowers and shit that was just mentioned, and just being this happening, as opposed to being a name or gain too, because if we're just change, there's that root of, you know, I'm a landowner, I'm a wealthy person. being certain things is kind of, we practice cutting that off.
I somehow, in writing this talk and looking in the Shobo Genzo, being time did not even occur to me. It was like, oh yeah, that's a whole different, totally Dogen-esque dimension of relating to this question. time, wasting time, useful time, productive time, the way we should be spending our time in terms of practice and just being time.
You know, John just answered my question about being time is fantastic, because I was going to tell you that the way we're brought up to be productive and become something and always be doing, I was going to say to the layperson, doing shikantaza is totally wasting time because you're sitting here doing nothing, but you are actually, like John said, being time. So that explains it.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good point. Yeah. Our zazen is totally useless. I mean, and really when it's most profound, I mean, and it isn't, right? In a certain sense, it's not, because of the effect it has on us and our lives, but in the moment, it's just like uselessness itself.
I don't know about Bob, but I can be angry for a long time. So, but I think one thing that he said, which resonated with me, is that you do, I mean, if I look at it and I really sit with it, at least I can kind of see where it's coming from, like what it's triggering, what's making it irk me so much. So that what he said about awareness or mindfulness or paying attention, I think that makes a lot of sense, but I've wasted a lot of time being angry at people and for different reasons.
Yeah, there's usually something, there's something gratifying. And this is like we, in the precept classes, we've been talking about how just every precept kind of involves all the other precepts. It makes me think about how this kind of relates in some ways to intoxication as well, right? All the different ways, because there's always, almost always something gratifying in however we're wasting our time. There's some kind of reward. We don't have to think about that, or we can distract ourselves from that, or we can feel, I mean, there's, it's intoxicating to like dwell on our resentments and our anger and rehearse the righteous things that we would, righteous points we would make if we could. And I think that's a useful thing to recognize and acknowledge, that when we're wasting time, like there's part of us that's really enjoying it.
I had another thought. They're always happening. Thoughts are the problem of thinking. I wish you'd talk about that for a little while. But you know, I had somebody ask me the other day, or comment to me, gosh, the zazen sit went by in like a couple minutes, but you know, it was really half an hour. And I said, that what actually happens when you experience that? What's going on? Because I said, and other times, if you're like me, it's like, when is this going to end? You know, I can't take it anymore. I can't, my mind is going crazy with thoughts. But I think in a true sense, that as long as you are open to what is happening in the very moment, each moment that you're sitting in zazen or in life, that in fact, none of that time is wasted. And I know in the past, I've felt strongly at times that I wasted my time sitting in zazen because nothing happened, or I didn't achieve a goal, or, you know, something like that. And that is not the case. Mm-hmm. We need to get away from that. I need to get away from that kind of thinking.
Etsido, and then we should wrap it up.
So, you know, one of the things that came up, and I appreciate everyone's comments, it was very fascinating, is, you know, having practiced a long time, I can see what how much time I've been wasting for such a long time. And one of the things that came up was spiritual bypassing as kind of wasting time in a way. You know, and I know I am so conditioned to pursue pleasant experiences and to avoid things that are not pleasant, that it's so easy just to bring that programming right to the cushion so that, you know, I sit down and I relax and I ease my mind and I ease my body. And there's this very pleasant state there. And it's just, I think for 30 years plus, I've been pursuing that very pleasant experience and really bypassing a lot of stuff that's there, you know, in the background that needs to be worked on. And I think it's so easy to engage this practice as a way to jump over, a way to skirt around, a way to try to avoid or dissolve, where something that I actually need to walk through, that I actually need to experience. And I think it's easy to waste time on the cushion, jumping over, walking around, sidestepping what's really on fire and burning. So that's just one thought that I had.
That's a very good point. There's so many dimensions to this. This is great. This good conversation could go on. Thank you all. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for being here. Love your doggy, Ken.
Yeah, me too. Good seeing everybody. Have a good week.
Thanks, Damiel.
Thank you all.